The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
In the early days of the American war in Vietnam, it of course occurred during the sort of period of the American Civil Rights Movement, when the forces of segregation were on the retreat and America was dismantling Jim Crow throughout most of the country. And the role of black soldiers became very prominent in the early days of the war. General William Westmoreland, who was the commanding general of American military forces in Vietnam for the bulk of the Vietnam War, was asked about the sort of role of black soldiers, that it would be unique for blacks to be playing such a prominent role in combat operations during Vietnam. And he asked what he thought about the role of black soldiers in the American military. And he said, "I have an intuitive feeling," you always have to be careful about that, "that the Negro serviceman has a better understanding than whites of what this war is about." Now, I think that was true, but not in the way that he thought. And that would be a problem with Mr. Westmoreland for most of the war, that in many ways he was a sort of oblivious buffoon to the most obvious things around him. Bob Moses, really, who was a leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who was quite a hero in the civil rights movement, particularly in Mississippi, spoke at one of the first anti-war demonstration against the war in Vietnam in April 1965, where he was asked, you know, why do you criticize the war in Vietnam? What do you know about Vietnam? And he said, "Our criticism of Vietnam does not come from what we know of Vietnam, but from what we know of America." Very simply, if you live in a racist, oppressive, violent, hypocritical, undemocratic nation, why should I throw my life away for you? I mean, that's giving you the long and sarcastic answer. Bob put it much more cryptically, but it gets it to the point. The Vietnam War was the longest war of the 20th century. It was the longest national liberation struggle of the 20th century. And it was one of the most violent wars of the 20th century. And all of these things in and of themselves would, of course, or should in and of themselves have produced a mass anti-war movement in this country. But I think it's safe to say that there wouldn't have been a mass anti-war movement in this country unless there was a civil rights and black liberation struggle first and foremost, partly because it brought an end to McCarthyism, it allowed the reemergence of mass political struggle. But really, to understand what took place in the 1960s and 1970s in this country, it's not just simply the struggle of black working class people, which is really what the civil rights and black liberation struggles are all about. These are the struggles of black working class people in the South, in the North, not only for democratic rights, but these struggles led to the rebirth and re-legitimation of radical ideas, anti-imperialist ideas, and allowed really a whole new generation to embrace politics, you know, that may be very different from ours in some way, but embrace a kind of revolutionary, a kind of socialist internationalism among a significant number of younger people for the first time in a generation. And so you can't really understand at all why there was the mass anti-war movement without really understanding that. It's funny that we're in the room Kitty Hawk, because in 1972, one of the biggest, most important mutiny of American soldiers in modern history took place in November 1972, when black sailors led 130 members of the Kitty Hawk staff from actually going aboard the aircraft carrier in San Diego, because Nixon was sending the aircraft carrier to carry out the last berth of death that he wanted to carry out before the end of the war. And of course, that's part of the hidden history of why the war ultimately came to an end, because at the end, I think we've argued for a long time, it's really the GI Rebellion, but in many ways it was a black-led GI Rebellion that brought about the end of the Vietnam War, and this is something that I'll get to in a little bit. But you know, every time I do a talk on Vietnam, I always, even though I think I'm gonna do something different, I always end up doing the same thing, which is, in order to understand why the war generated such opposition within the African American community, and why the opposition within the African American political movements had such a big impact, is you have to go back to the center of where the struggle took place, which is you have to go back to Vietnam. Because you have you have what I was saying about Vietnam being the longest war, the longest national liberation struggle, and the most violent struggle, is that it takes place in a very important political context, which in some ways is a little different from today. That is, All these things take place with the emergence of the United States as a global power after the Second World War. It takes place in the context of the death of European colonialism and the emergence of what was then called the Third World, and the Black Freedom Movement in the United States. And all these things really play off of one another. In many ways, you can say that two of the most important struggles, the Vietnamese struggle in Vietnam against the French and then the American presence, and then the Black liberation struggle at home, these are the two forces that are may not be aware of each other, but they come together in the late 1960s to help generate a mass opposition, which takes its most important form inside the military today. So what I thought I'd do is just go over a little bit about the Vietnamese national struggle, why the U.S. fought the type of war it did, why it generated such opposition within in Black America. Because I think without doing those things, you don't get a complete picture, and you don't. It doesn't quite make it make sense. Now, how many people here have seen the film Hearts and Minds, the documentary? Couple? Not enough? You guys haven't seen it? You haven't seen it? Oh, okay, well that's shame, shame, right? So we point our fingers, shame on you guys, you know? Hearts and Minds is probably, along with Sir, No Sir, the two best documentaries made in English about the Vietnam War. And there's many things about Hearts and Minds that are amazing. When it won the Oscar for Best Documentary in 1975, it actually led to a fist fight off stage at the Oscars. And those are the type of, you know, those are the type of Oscar ceremonies you wish for, right? Not these sort of parade out with your dresses and jewelry and, you know, people fawning each other. You want a good fist fight over something controversial, right? There's one part of Hearts and Minds that I think is really great. There's a scene where there's a Vietnamese Catholic priest. His name is Father Chan Tin. He's still alive. He still lives in Vietnam. Where he was interviewed by the Hearts and Minds producers and director Peter Davis, and he said, well, can you summarize the Vietnamese struggle for us? And he simply said, we fought 1,000 years against the Chinese, we fought 100 years against the French, and then after the historic defeat of the French at Dien Bien Phu, the Americans arrived. And then year after year, we fought a war against the genocide that was being committed against our people by the American army. And in a very pithy way, he kind of sums up, you know, 1,000 years of Vietnamese history with that. And what it should tell people, unique sense of national consciousness, which I think explains the tenacity of the Vietnamese struggle for so many decades to free their country from foreign domination. That's one thing. I think the other thing is that there's important political turning points in the Vietnamese struggle, which in some funny ways mirrors the struggle of African Americans for freedom in this country. One turning point was the First World War. It weakened colonialism very significantly. And the American president at the time was Woodrow Wilson. Now, Woodrow Wilson is one of the most vile and hypocritical people in American history. He watched Birth of a Nation in the White House and described it as history written with lightning. But he tried to project American power in the world by saying that the United States supported the right of nations to self-determination. One Vietnamese exile took up Wilson's offer. His name was Nguyen Ai Quoc. The world came to know him as Ho Chi Minh. And he would approach Wilson at the Versailles Peace Treaty ceremonies after the First World War to get the United States government to recognize Vietnamese independence. He was turned away by the American delegation, and it would be the first of many attempts by Ho Chi Minh to approach the Americans to support the Vietnamese right to an independent nation. There's many ironic and tragic parts to the Vietnamese story, but they're important to understand. Ho Chi Minh would later be, after getting the door slammed in his face by Woodrow Wilson, would later be inspired by the Bolshevik Revolution, who actually did support the right of nations to self-determination, and he would later found the Communist Party of Vietnam, which would eventually lead the national liberation struggle. The second most important turning point was really World War II. World War II leads to both the emergence of the United States as the dominant world power, which began to stick its fingers into every part of the globe. It also led to really the death of European colonialism and importantly, the sort of death of white supremacy, which was the underpinning of old-fashioned European colonialism. Vietnam itself was occupied by the Japanese during the bulk of the Second World War, and the French who were the colonial overseers of Vietnam, collaborated with the Japanese in the same way the French collaborated with the Germans during the occupation of France. Ho Chi Minh returned to Vietnam in 1940, convinced the Communist Party to found a broadly based national liberation struggle known as the League for the Independence of Vietnam. It was known by its acronym, the Viet Minh. And they waged a five-year guerrilla struggle against both the French and the Japanese as allies of the United States. Ho Chi Minh was actually considered an agent for the Office of Strategic Services, and American OSS officers, the predecessors of the CIA, actually sent American agents to Vietnam to train the Viet Minh in the art of guerrilla warfare, and ironically, to help find downed American pilots who would be shot down or wounded by the Japanese who would crash land their planes into Vietnam. There's a novel in there somewhere. I'll write it at some point. With the collapse of Japanese power in 1945, the Viet Minh, who had the broad support of a large bulk of the Vietnamese population, assumed political power inside of Vietnam. And on September 2nd, 1945, Ho Chi Minh, in front of 200,000 Vietnamese people in Hanoi, declared Vietnam's independence using the following words: "We hold these truths to be by the Creator with certain inalienable rights." And of course, we know those words because they're the opening lines of the Communist Manifesto. Now, the Ho Chi Minh, obviously, he cleared this with the OSS. He said, "You know, I'm going to say this." And they said, "Great." And so forth. American planes actually flew over the ceremony by accident. People cheered them. And of course, 20 years later, planes with American flags on them would be dropping bombs on those same people. The United States, however, had no intention of recognizing Vietnamese independence, and then they essentially supported the French recolonizing the country. And there was a nine-year war in which there were over 2 million Vietnamese casualties. The French fought their war mostly with mercenaries, French foreign legionnaires, 15,000 of whom had fought for the Nazis in the Second World War. Just so you, the caliber of mercenaries doesn't really change over time. And much of the language that would later be used during the American War, such phrases as "light at the end of the tunnel," the French called it yellowing, Americans called it Vietnam. I know it's a really disgusting term, isn't it? All really developed during the French occupation. In fact, the Americans by 1952 were paying 80% of the French war in Vietnam. If you see Hearts and Minds again, they'll show you old-fashioned newsreels from the 1950s, and you look at the French soldiers and you go, "God, they look so American." And that's because they were wearing American helmets, American uniforms, driving American jeeps, using American weapons. In 1953, at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the French were finally and decisively defeated at that point. And this is where the Americans sort of intervened directly in Vietnam. They wanted to, as much as possible, not only have a say in whatever happens in any part of the world, but now being the predominant defender of the capitalist world, wanted to make sure that there was nothing that could be struck as a rival coming to power. So the Americans basically violated what was called the Geneva Accords, which called for Vietnam to be temporarily divided. There'd be elections and so forth. It was recognized by the CIA that if there were fair elections in Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh would win overwhelmingly. The Americans made sure that no elections were held. And in the Republic of Vietnam, which is really the southern half of Vietnam, the Americans created a police state led by a Catholic seminarian. Catholics are responsible for all sorts of terrible things in the world, named Ngo Dinh Diem, who set himself up as a little dictatorship. And what he proceeded to do was to impose a bloodbath on South Vietnam. With the help of the CIA and a police program sponsored by the University of Michigan, Ngo Dinh Diem killed at least 50,000 former supporters of the Viet Minh, imprisoned tens of thousands of others, and there's just tens of thousands of other people who just simply disappeared. This was considered a great victory for the Americans, and Ngo Dinh Diem was described by Eisenhower and other people as a great leader of the free world. It should be pointed out that some of Diem's biggest supporters in this country were actually liberals and socialists. The Vietnam Lobby, which was the sort of shorthand term for the Committee of Friends of Vietnam, was actually founded by John Kennedy. Cardinal Spellman, who was sometimes called the American Pope, was the leader behind it. And Norman Thomas, who was some water, and Norman Thomas, who was the leader of the American Socialist Party, all founded the Friends of Vietnam Committee and helped promote DM to the American government. However, like I was saying about the Vietnamese struggle being quite tenacious, is despite this huge set in the 60s, in 1960, the National Liberation Front, which was deliberately seen as a successor to the Viet Minh, launched a struggle to push Diem and his American allies out of South Vietnam. And the Kennedy and Johnson years, and these are the years of liberalism in America, right? This is the high point of liberalism in the United States, essentially launched a war to crush any opponents of the Saigon government. Under the Kennedy administration, they essentially launched the proxy war. In 1960, when I was born, which if you do the quick math, means I'm 27, there were 500 American advisors in Vietnam. By the time that Kennedy was killed in 1963, there were 15,000 American advisors who were leading combat operations. After the American failure in Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, they were very determined not to be seen as defeated in Vietnam, and they used Vietnam really as a laboratory for all sorts of counterinsurgency programs, all sorts of ways that they thought they could destroy the base of the National Liberation Front. Despite the pouring out of American aid and the incredible bloodbath of the Diem and Kennedy years, the fact was is that by the time of Kennedy's assassination, the Viet Minh controlled over 65% of the countryside. After Kennedy was killed, Lyndon Johnson becomes president and manufactures an incident called the Tonkin Gulf incident. I could talk to people about that later, more specifically. It's used as an excuse as kind of the WMD scandal of the time to justify getting legal authority to launch a war in Vietnam. And Johnson, who was elected president on essentially an anti-war program in 1964, who said, you know, I'm not going to send American boys to do what Asian boys should be doing. If you vote for that nut Barry Goldwater, he'll take you into war in Vietnam. And none of us want that, right? Was elected overwhelmingly president, and 3 months later took the United States into total war in Vietnam. Why did the U.S. fight a war in Vietnam? I mean, why is this place in the middle of literally nowhere? You know, the type of place that the Americans thought that so much was at stake. Well, you know, in 1965, Robert McNamara, who's kind of the Donald Rumsfeld of his time, they actually kind of look alike, too. It's kind of weird when you look at pictures of them, asked his assistant, Robert McNaughton, who was from Illinois, could you summarize what our war aims are? Because, you know, we have to convince people why we, you know, you should send your sons to die in Vietnam. And he wrote up a little list of why, you know, what the reasons were. And he said 70% of the reason we're fighting a war in Vietnam is to not be humiliated. Okay. 20% is to prevent the emergence of a pro-Chinese government. This is not getting good, right? You're not going, hey, I gotta, you know, send my kids. And 10%, this is the real kicker, to make sure that the Vietnamese have a better life. So, if you have 10 bombs dropping on you, the question is making sure the one that's for a better life hits you, I guess. And of course, the Americans brought, the type of war that they brought to Vietnam was really quite horrendous. It's now sort of seen as the American anti-war movement was hysterical about claims about what the Americans did in Vietnam. If anything, what's been revealed since the war is how people were not aware of the total destruction that the United States brought to Vietnam. Westmoreland called his war in Vietnam, his war strategy, war of attrition, which sounds like playing chess, doesn't it? You move pawns around a table or something. What it really means is that you basically destroy enough of the male population in the enemy territory that it can't replenish its army. That's what a war of attrition means. I mean, it sounds like meat grinder, which is a lot more accurate idea of what the Americans did there. To give you a few facts on what this meant in practice, was that, for example, since the war was fought mostly in the countryside, the Americans were obsessed with destroying the cover for the National Liberation Front. So they just dropped herbicides all over South Vietnam in particular, but also North Vietnam. The most famous of them was Agent Orange, which caused horrible deformities and cancers. They dropped, it is estimated, 100 million pounds of herbicides all over Vietnam. Bombing Vietnam became a huge political issue in this country, but also internationally during the war. And it's one of those things that sometimes Americans still don't quite understand what bombing does to countries. Here's something I'll just take from my book to give people an idea of what it really meant. Bombing was and still is one of the great sacred cows of the American way of war. America's massive industrial infrastructure allowed it to build a huge air force and a virtually limitless amount of ordnance, that's bombs, during the Cold War. The B-52, which was originally designed for dropping nuclear weapons on Russia, was refitted for conventional warfare in Vietnam with devastating results. The United States dropped more than 1 million tons of bombs on North Vietnam and more than 4 million tons on South Vietnam. That is our ally. All right? The amount of bombs dropped by the United States on South Vietnam in the air war alone, now that doesn't, that excludes, you know, the use of artillery, was double the tonnage it used in all of the Second World War. Life was made unbearable in the South Vietnamese countryside. While it was probably an underestimate, the United States Subcommittee on Refugees reported that the civilian casualties in South Vietnam, at 400,000 dead, this is a country of 27 million people, 900,000 wounded, and 6.4 million refugees by 1971. It concluded, now this is the U.S. Senate, right? This is not Socialist Worker, that there is hardly a family in South Vietnam that has not suffered a death, an injury, or the anguish of abandoning an ancient homestead. That gives you some idea of the total destruction of what they brought to Vietnam. And of course, the other thing the Americans brought to Vietnam was their racism. It's almost been completely, no pun intended, whitewashed away the incredible racism that the Americans brought to Vietnam. And we're not just talking about the casual, everyday bigotry of American soldiers referring to people in the disgusting ways as slopes or dinks or gooks, which is disgusting enough. But this really starts at the top. George Patton III, who was the son of the notorious World War II commander, sent out greeting cards during Christmas in 1967, which had a pile of Viet Cong dead bodies, which said, "Peace on Earth." And he sent these out to people. If I got that from somebody, I'd have him committed, right? But he was a highly decorated commander. William Westmoreland was interviewed in Hearts and Minds, where he was asked about Vietnam and what he thought of the Vietnamese, and he said that the Oriental, first of all, this is just reveals something about that whatever Orientals are. When he was asked about the Vietnamese, don't value life like Americans do. This is the guy who dropped 5 million tons of bombs on Vietnam. To them, life is cheap, and I think really it's kind of an example of reverse psychology and a really kind of the bombing, the racism, the destruction of Vietnam, the idea that Vietnam is trying to emerge from an era of colonialism are all the things that make up the important aspect of why there was a huge anti-war movement in this country. But it particularly resonated among African Americans. Now, of course, to say a few things about African Americans and America's wars, this is the first thing you always have to say, is that African Americans have fought in all of America's wars, whether they fought as combat soldiers or in secondary positions or as sailors or so forth. But what's always been distasteful and hypocritical is that despite the exhortation that African Americans should serve in some way in America's military forces and in exchange they'll get better conditions or full citizenship, is that in all of America's wars, African Americans' hopes have always been dashed, that they continue to suffer bigotry and hatred and racial oppression in this country. Some of the worst things occurred in the 20th century, where returning World War I and World War II vets were literally lynched in their uniforms. There was a horrible case after the Second World War of a decorated Marine named Isaac Woodard, who was in Maryland, had both of his eyes in uniform, has eyes gouged out by nightsticks by local cops. These things were typical of what would happen to veterans in this country. But like the Vietnamese struggle, World War II was a huge turning point because it raised expectations that life would be different. And African Americans actually, despite the fact that it was a horribly segregated and racist army, actually took African Americans all over the world. And it was a huge change in consciousness that was brought back to this country by returning veterans. And even though the Cold War kind of stifled the emergence of a civil rights movement for over a decade, the fact was is that it laid the basis for a real criticism of what would later become the war in Vietnam. Now, of course, on the eve of the Vietnam War, the unique thing about the American military is that it was one of the few institutions in America which didn't actually hang Jim Crow on its front door. Harry Truman, for reasons that are very complicated and have more to do with international foreign policy, desegregated the American military in the late 1940s. And this created this kind of friction between the military and many of the southern states where the largest American military bases were. Like you go to the south, the army bases, the naval bases, the marine training bases, or the largest ones, except for California, are all through Georgia, the Carolinas, and so forth. And so during the 1950s, if you look at the opinion polls, African Americans in general had a much more favorable attitude towards the American military than it did towards many other institutions. Now this rapidly changed during the course of the 1960s, because one thing that black soldiers or sailors and airmen learned very quickly is that integration and racism could easily coincide with one another. Now in the 1960s, obviously we have the emergence of a huge civil rights movement. It begins in the mid-50s, but really sort of escalates during the course of the 1960s. And as I was saying in the introduction, there's this kind of rebirth of not only the idea of mass political struggle, but also a kind of taking the lid off and a criticism of what really American society was. Because if you go to the 1950s, you have this stifling Cold War atmosphere and this kind of ridiculous chirpy babble about America as the most perfect society in the world, the freest country in the world. You know what I'm talking about, the freest country in the world. Of course, the African-American struggle kind of lifts the lid on all of this stuff. And it had, and not just in terms of what America was like, but also America's role in the world. It's not surprising at all that I think that when you begin to, in the early 60s, that after the Bay of Pigs, and then the American attempt to destroy Castro through a proxy army there, the American role in the murder of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, and in several other nefarious foreign policy operations, that particularly among African Americans, that there's this growing criticism of America's role in the world. And the person who really articulates this first is Malcolm X. Is that while Malcolm was killed before the introduction of large numbers of American troops in Vietnam, he was asked in many different occasions, you know, what would you think about African Americans serving in the American military? What do you think of American foreign policy? And, you know, you always got straight talk from Malcolm. I mean, there was no beating around the bush and stuff. And so as early as August 10th, 1963, now this is on the eve of the historic March on Washington, it's even before that, he was asked about, you know, should blacks join the American army? And that was his opening. And he says, when he says Muslims, he's referring to the Nation of Islam, just so people know specifically. He says, as Muslims, we don't go to war. We don't get drafted. We don't join anybody's army. If you're dumb enough to fight someone who doesn't mean you any, it means you no good. If you're dumb enough to fight for something you've never gotten, if you're dumb enough to be as dumb as your brothers who went into Korea and came back and still caught hell, if you're dumb enough to follow in the footsteps of your older brothers during the World War II who fought all over the South Pacific, like Isaac Woodard, who came back here to this country and got his eyes punched out by the police right here in this country, if you're dumb enough behind what you know about the white man today to let him stick him in his uniform and send you overseas, well, you can go on to hell and fight. But I'm not that dumb. For me, and I can only speak for myself, because that's because if you were to advocate that to publicly, you could be tried for sedition. That's why he says, for myself. I'll go to jail. I'll go to prison. Stick me in jail. Let me go to prison. But don't give me your uniform and don't give me your rifle, because I might use it on someone that you don't intend me to use it on. Don't put me in your airplane and fill it with bombs and tell me to go bomb the enemy. Well, I don't have to go that far to find that enemy. This is a footnote. It's a straight talk, right? This is a footnote. When he came up to report for his draft board during the Second World War, he feigned mental illness by going in and saying, yeah, I want to join your army. I want to go down south and kill me some crackers. And they stamped him 4F and there's a lot of twists and turns to the thing about the emergence of sort of anti-war sentiment among African Americans during during Vietnam. The two important turning points for people was not just simply what was going on in Africa, other things, but also here in the United States. In 1964, in the summer, when you saw an attempt by the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party to actually unseat the segregationist traditional regular Democrats from the convention in Atlantic City, and were then told by virtually everybody in the leadership of the civil rights movement, including Martin Luther King, that they should accept a deal to take the position of two observers. That was a huge turning point for a lot of African-American activists, because until that time, despite the criticisms of Kennedy and Johnson's waffling on civil rights, some mechanism for alleviating the conditions that African-Americans faced. After what happens in the summer convention, it completely changes. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which is sometimes not appreciated as much as it should be, I think, by people, actually articulated a lot of the anti-imperialist sentiment that would later become fairly commonplace among the left. In July 1965, before the convention, this is before they got knifed over the seating of delegates, they were asked, you know, what do you say about what Lyndon Johnson is doing in the Dominican Republic and Vietnam? And they issued a statement that simply said, no one has a right to ask us to risk our lives and kill the other colored people in Santo Domingo and Vietnam so that the white American can get richer. We will be looked upon as traitors by the colored people of the world. Now, people should remember that phrase, the colored people of the world. That is the idea that our struggle here is connected with the struggle of other oppressed people around the globe. If the Negro people continue to fight and die without cause. Malcolm X used a phrase that because African Americans think black, they can think beyond the confines of America. And all he simply means is that our struggle is connected with the struggle of other people. Now, the most important civil rights, black freedom organization to come out against the Vietnam War, and this had a huge impact on white radicals also across the country, in the early days of the war was SNCC. Now, SNCC, of course, was the vanguard in many ways of the civil rights movement in the early 1960s. And for many people, black and white across America, they were like living heroes to people. They were people who were killed, who put their lives on the line. They spoke all over the country. They lived in poverty. They fought the good fights. And they became, in many ways, the sort of axle by which a lot of radicalism flowed around. During the course of 1965, they actually avoided for a very long time coming out against the war in Vietnam because they were beginning to feel isolated from many other civil rights organizations. Howard Zinn, who was sort of an advisor to SNCC, kept arguing with them that it would be important for them to come out against the war, and they sort of agreed that they would. But it wasn't until January 1966, after one of their members, Sammy Young, who actually was a Navy veteran, who had lost a kidney in the Navy, was trying to use a bathroom in a whites-only gas station and was knifed to death there. The morning beforehand, he had attempted to get 40 people to register to vote in Macomb, Alabama. It was after Sammy Young was murdered that SNCC came out against the war, and they adopted the following statement. We believe the United States government has been deceptive in its claims of concern for the freedom of the Vietnamese people. Just as the government has been deceptive in claiming concern for the freedom of the colored people in such countries as the Dominican Republic, the Congo, South Africa, Rhodesia, and the United States itself. The murder of Samuel Young in Tuskegee, Alabama, is no different from the murder of people in Vietnam, for both Young and the Vietnamese sought and are seeking to secure rights guaranteed them by law. In each case, the United States bears a great part of the responsibility for these deaths. Sammy Young was murdered because the United States law is not being enforced. Vietnamese people are being murdered because the United States is pursuing an aggressive policy in violation of international law. We are in sympathy with and support the men in this country who were unwilling to respond to the military draft, which would compel them to contribute their lives to the United States aggression in the name. That statement alone had a huge impact, not only on anti-war activism, but also on draft resistance in this country. The most important figure in draft resistance in the movement as a whole and its impact particularly not only on African Americans but on people who considered themselves revolutionaries and anti-imperialists in other countries was clearly Muhammad Ali. There's a great book overall called Blacks in America's Wars, and it was written by someone who's sympathetic with another political party called the Socialist Workers Party in this country. The one missing element in Blacks in America's Wars is that if you look up in the index Muhammad Ali, there's not one reference to him in the book, and that's because they didn't support draft resistance, but that's another small point. Ali became the most important figure in this in the 1960s simply because who he was. He was the world heavyweight and champion. In 1966, when he was first made eligible for the draft, he'd actually failed the mental aptitude tests at the time earlier. They lowered them in order to get more people to fight in the Vietnam War. He was asked by a New York Times reporter what he thought of the Vietnam War, and he simply said, "Man, I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong." In 1967, after he was convicted of draft evasion by an all-white Houston jury, some things never change in this country, he was sentenced to prison for 5 years. And he basically carried out a campaign for the next 3 years, not only to vindicate himself, but to really kind of place himself as a figure leading the draft resistance and the anti-war movement. And he was. This is typical of the speeches that he gave at the time. Ali, it's important to remember, he never backed down on this stuff, even though in some ways he's kind of commercialized his image. He's never rejected the anti-war stuff that he did in the 1960s. This is typical of some of the things that he said. "Why should they ask me to put on a uniform and go 10,000 miles from home and drop bombs and bullets on brown people in Vietnam while the so-called Negro people in Louisville," that was his hometown, "are treated like dogs and simply denied human rights? This is the day when such evils must come to an end. I have been warned that to take such a stand would cost me millions. But I have said it once and I will say it again. The real enemy of my people is here. I have nothing to lose to standing up for my beliefs, so I'll go to jail. So what? We've been in jail for 400 years." And Ali's impact, really, of his to the draft radicalized literally a whole generation of young people. Sometimes that's, you know, we emphasize the importance of the Panthers a lot, but Ali was an iconic figure in terms of making this stuff legitimate. And of course, the Black Panthers kind of gave a very pithy and political focus to a lot of this sentiment. Founded in October 1966, they would grow to several thousand people, but their influence was much larger. In 1967, they issued a statement very simply about the question of black men in the war in Vietnam. They simply said, "We believe that black people should not be forced to fight in military service to defend a racist government that does not protect us." That's pretty straightforward, isn't it? "We will not fight and kill other people of color in a world who, like black people, are victimized by the white racist government of the United States. We will protect ourselves from the force and violence of the racist police and the racist military by whatever means necessary." By June 1970, according to a secret FBI report, approximately 25% of the black population had great respect for the Panthers, including 43% of blacks under the age of 21. That is the same group. During the course of the 60s, these political ideas get absorbed by a large number of African-American working-class youth who participate in some of the biggest urban rebellions that take place during the course of the 1960s. The most famous before the uprisings after King's death were in Newark, New Jersey, and in Detroit. And these are the same people that were being drafted into the military. Of course, the most important figure to come out against the war in Vietnam in the African-American community and represented really the hopes of millions of people, both black and white, was Martin Luther King. Now, of course, today King is considered a kind of iconic figure who's sort of celebrated by both George Bush, McDonald's, Burger King, and they try to completely suck out of King's image anything that may smack of radicalism and so forth. But if you go back and you look at King's speeches, and I won't read the whole thing, where he simply talks of when he spoke out against the war in Vietnam at the Riverside Church in 1967, you can get a feel for what the impact of King's anti-war stance was. Here's one thing that he simply said about his experiences with the urban rebellions and the war in Vietnam. This is after the Watts Rebellion of 65. He goes, "As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. But they ask, what about Vietnam? The question hits me home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first clearly spoken to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government." And it should be remembered that King was, the political establishment as a whole swung heavily to attack and to try to destroy King because of his anti-war stances. Life magazine accused Martin Luther King of, quote, "demagogic slander that sounds like a script from Radio Hanoi." The NAACP came out and said, attacked King by saying, "We are not a foreign policy organization. We are a civil rights organization. The Washington Post declared that it was a grave injury to the civil rights movement when he spoke out against the war, and it, quote, diminished his usefulness. By the way, that's an interesting phrase, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Diminished his usefulness to his cause, to his country, and to his people. One result of King coming out against the war was that J. Edgar Hoover and Lyndon Johnson agreed that they would no longer notify King of death threats against his life. Just so people know. That's one of the things that's important about that. The impact among black soldiers of all of this is quite important, because in many of the activism that would take place within the military, whether it's the organizations like GIs, United Against the War in Vietnam, anti-war newsletters, demonstrations, and so forth, many of these were led by black soldiers first and foremost. This would, of course, lead to take a qualitative step forward and lead in many ways to the disintegration of the army following Martin Luther King's assassination. Now, after King was assassinated, over 125 American cities saw rebellions. This rebellion then got expressed inside of the American military all over the world. At Cam Ranh Bay, the night following, which was the big American naval base in Vietnam, the night after King was killed, white Marines dressed up in Ku Klux Klan outfits and raised the Confederate flag in the celebration of King's assassination. It would be black soldiers who knocked some heads to make sure that that didn't happen again. But there was literally a rebellion by black soldiers all over the world following King's assassination. Terry Whitmore, who wrote a book called From Memphis, Sweden, and Nam, recalls very much when he said that he was in a hospital in Japan recovering from his wounds. He says that I would never go back to the war in Vietnam after King was killed. And the radicalization that took place among black soldiers is quite amazing. Wallace Terry, who later wrote a book called Bloods, an Oral History of Vietnam, did a survey in 1971 of black soldiers where 60% of black soldiers that he interviewed said that they would use their military training to come when they got home and put it at the service of the Black Panther Party or other revolutionary groups. The same 60% thought that race relations in the United States were going to get worse. And of them, of that same 60%, over two-thirds of them agreed that black men had no stake in the war in Vietnam. So where does all this sort of, you know, come to an end? This was recognized, by the way, that the civil rights movement and particularly King's assassination, well, King coming out against the war and then King's assassination, had a huge impact on the ability of the American military to function. Commander George Jackson, who was a professor at the Navy Command School in Maryland, wrote a report, now you can't make this stuff up, called The Constraints of the Negro Civil Rights Movement on the American Military. And where he argued was it was basically the coming together of the left wing of the civil rights movement with the anti-war movement that shifted public opinion against the war in Vietnam. And at the paramount moment in that was King's anti-war speech. Now what does all this sort of mean for us really today? And of course I think that I tried to say at the beginning of the talk that there are things that are very specific about the war in Vietnam and why it produced a mass movement. The Vietnamese national liberation struggle was the longest struggle of the 20th century. It had defeated two powers, the French and then the Americans. It was one of the most violent wars of the 20th century, particularly the American bombing campaign turned off tens of millions of people around the globe from what the U.S. was doing there. And it was one of the longest wars of the 20th century. But the one thing that you have to say about the reasons why there was a mass anti-war movement in the United States is because there was a mass movement against racism in this country, so that when the American ground war begins in Vietnam, there's not only a large section of the African American population that was at best suspicious about what the United States was going to do in Vietnam, but even larger numbers of blacks and whites and others in this country who were already predisposed to oppose what the United States was doing in Vietnam. last thing I'll just say about the issue of black soldiers in Vietnam is that, you know, one of the things about you can't separate what goes on in the military from what goes on in the so-called civilian world. That if you have a low level of struggle in the country, you're going to see that reflected inside the military itself. And that rebuilding a mass anti-war movement in this country, or maybe creating an anti-war movement for the first time around Iraq in this country, part of that takes, I think, the reemergence of struggle here, because that will the one lesson of Vietnam is that the racial oppression, particularly of African Americans, should be not only in the forefront of the struggles here in the United States, but how that plays itself out inside such a horribly racist institution like the United States military and the racist wars that it fights around the world are the type of things that under the right conditions will produce mass opposition in this country and hopefully will bring an end to the war in Iraq today. So I'll just end that.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.